But now we're moving into a new era, and today's lecture is about a hot mess. That's what the early universe is. And the plan is, remember at the beginning says I'm teaching a history course, so today's plan is to teach the history of the universe, the part that the middle part of where everything is messy and hot. And then we'll introduce some tools to study the hot mess. And tomorrow we're gonna apply the tools to CMB. And in the afternoon tutorial, you will apply the tools. The ideas how to apply the tools are very similar, so you will just apply the tools again to BBN. So even if you're not officially taking the course, I encourage you to come to tomorrow's tutorial, because otherwise BBN is a very nice thing about Big Bang Theory. Basically, that's the calculation people did, and which Big Bang Theory become the standard model of the cosmology, and people stopped talking about the state universe, which proposed random stuff just pop off out of nowhere, and the universe has been like this forever. Okay, history. So before we talk about a history, we have to talk about something called language. So basically, if you ask a human being, then you know, how old are you? I understand it's not a common question to ask in some countries, but suppose you ask, and you'll get to the results in years, you know, months, sometimes hours. But if you ask the universe, how old are you? You actually get back the answer in various kind of answers. They could have been the things I just talked about, or minutes or seconds. But of course, more often than not, if you read textbook or literature, the age is coming back in terms of redshift, and the temperature, the energy scale of the universe, and years, and at least I was very confused, you know, when reading all this book, like, how come that when, you know, at the universe, when redshift is equals 3400, this thing happens. It's like, huh? Oh, then often they will show up, comma. By the way, the universe is 60,000 years at that point, this happens. So I was a little bit confused, so I want to clean this up. So this is called a units conversion. So that actually they are all very simple calculations. It's just people don't say it explicitly. The first thing is really called E equals KBT, and you take this KB to be 1. Yesterday we already talked about this. Then you can convert a kelvin with electrovolts. The conversion is 1 kelvin is about 10 to the minus 4 electron volts. So whenever you say a temperature, you just divide it by a factor of 10 force. And that's often what you say about the energy of, say, a typical photon at that time. Well, there is a factor of 3 if it's a typical photon. So that's very simple. And the other simple thing is what we have seen again and again, is that the redshift is directly related to scale factor. So now we're already in the early universe, so we can just say that Z is always large. Then it's really just say Z is the inverse of A. And the third thing is what we also mentioned, is the temperature is inverse of A. This is always the temperature of the photons. And for photons, there are various arguments using all sorts. It's related to Planck distribution, and you do some integration, calculate the energy, and you realize it's 1 over A4, so you can directly use Wien's law, says that the where the peak wavelength shows up is proportional to T gamma. So basically, since we have that, so basically temperature is proportional to redshift. So this is nice. So if somebody says redshift is 1,000, you know immediately the temperature is about 3,000 Kelvin. And using this, it's about 0.3 electrovolts. So they are related, and they are all linear related. So which is why I guess people just mention them as a matter of fact. So of course, the last thing is actually the real age in seconds or years in this normal unit. So the approach of this is also simple. It's not directly convertible in your head because there is a factor of. So basically, the approach is what we know from the first week is A is proportional to T to the 1/2, and matter is 1T is 2/3, A to T to the 2/3. So you can basically set up some equation. We're going to make things simple by taking curvature equals 0, which, as we argue, curvature never, if it's not important today, it was never important and will never be important. So that's very legit. We're going to do a less legit assumption, is to assumption the dark energy is equal 0. And of course, it's not true today. It's 0.7. But you can compensate this by assuming today's age is 12 billion years instead of 14 billion years. Remember the first tutorial you did? That if you, assuming there is no dark energy, then that it would be age would be a little younger, and you actually have explicit formula hidden in the footnote. If you plug that in number, basically you say, let's remove the dark energy, and let's say how old the universe would approximately be, that's how old. So if we have that, we can just say, now we are in the matter era, then we have A proportional to T to the 2/3. And normally people somehow don't talk about a scale factor because, you know, it's always 1 over a big number. So it's very hard to say, okay, this thing happened at 0.001 scale factor, and the other ones happens at the 0.0003. It's just a harder way of to talk about things. That's why they always just use Z, which is 1 over A. It says the universe is that much smaller from today. So we're going to do the same. Normally, people use the temperature. So we know anytime. So temperature would be inversely proportional to the time. So that's what they typically do, is that we know today's temperature is 2.73 or 25 Kelvin. I don't have to keep that many digits. I'm doing all sorts of round up here. But that's what they typically do. People says, look, this is what happens if it's matter era, that's how temperature is related to time to a factor of 2/3, then we can just solve this guy up. So this equation work up until radiation take over. But I already mentioned it yesterday, it's very easy to calculate one radiation takeover. It's exactly when this happens. And if you calculate the Z is equals to, I might have read some other number, but 3,400, 3,500, 3,600. It depends on some neutrinos. It's radiation. So you know exactly how this work until. Because you know Z, you can actually know, for example, radiation matter equality, you can calculate temperature is exactly Z times that number. When we go back, the temperature might get much higher. And at precisely one, this takeover time, that the temperature, if you multiply those things, It's about 10,000 Kelvin. If you do some calculation, maybe it's become like 0.75 times 10,000 Kelvin, some prefactor. And this immediately tells you it's about 1 eV. So that's when you say, okay, that formula doesn't work anymore. Now it's the radiation era. So we have a new equation. It's just now the universe evolved as a T^1/2. And now, oh, okay. So solve that, if you plug in this number to that equation, use calculator, you'll solve this happens at 60,000 years. And now I have new condition. I can plug in this. And then since before that, it's all radiation dominating. Once radiation dominating, it dominates forever. So then we can just use this formula. And a key thing that you might want to remember, because it's very interesting, is that at about 1 second, the temperature is 1 MeV. You would actually derive the 1 MeV because that's when neutrinos decouple. I mean, the homework too is called the neutrinos. So a key event happens. It says the weak theory, the weak interaction, well, by definition, is not that strong, that is not going to be able to keep up with the Hubble expansion, so it decouples. And this is the temperature of the universe when it happens. And if you use this formula with all these conditions, you realize it happens around that 1 second. And if you want to know more about how to go back, you just use this formula. So there's nothing mysterious. This we know, this we learned. And then there are some linear relationships. So that's why that in the book, they never, sometimes some books talk about it, sometimes don't. But they always just say, this happens at a redshift or something. The universe is at this temperature, and the energy is this. Typical energy of the universe is that. So after we clear this up, what we can almost start talk about the history of the universe. But this is clear. This is basically summarize everything we have already seen before. But I just want to summarize on one board so that from now on, I will be like those books that I was reading that I'll just mention randomly in terms of redshift or temperature or years. But that those are the things we convert from. Okay? So this redshift, temperature, and energy, they are very easy. Whenever you see a redshift, you multiply it by today's temperature, that it will give you that temperature, then divided by 10^4, you'll get the energy. But if you want to get precisely in which years that in the universe it happens, then you need to do some, you need to plug in either this one or that one formula to figure it out. Okay. So basically that's how we describe the history of the universe. So when you talk about it, but if you like open a history book, they don't tell you today at 9 a.m. the king eats breakfast. It includes, and then at 9:01 a.m. what happens? Normally they just say, oh, in this year 1616, I remember this very clearly because I'm Chinese, but that's when a very important king in the Qing dynasty decided to start taking over the previous dynasty. Like important events are important. They don't talk about normally life, especially for universe. We can't really have, you know, a history record is like, this second universe expand a little bit. It's like the universe expandable. That's pretty boring. So normally you just list the key events. So when does the key events happen? Well, the key events happens when So first I should say that we're trying to basically use an equilibrium approach, but of course the universe is not in global equilibrium with anything because the temperature is changing. So what we meant is the universe most of the time, really like a majority of the time, is like 90% of the time, maybe even more than that, is in local equilibrium. The local equilibrium is defined by it's at a status of maximum entropy. So it's expanding, but it's expanding in a way that it's always maximally randomized because the interaction is so fast. They just erase anything that has any order. So, but, you know, as I just briefly mentioned, the interaction rate might not be able to keep up with the Hubble rate. So the thing we want to compare here is the interaction rate for any particular interaction. You can calculate that, which you spend, we spend a whole course on calculating these things. And Hubble is Hubble. So we have two things to describe how fast things are happening. And interaction, well, because at the universe in the beginning, they are all teeny, teeny, and all the particle has a large density. So you would assume if you go far back enough, the interaction is always strong enough because there are just simply so many of the particles. But as the universe dilutes, there are less likely to be, you can't find anybody to run into, then of course the Hubble eventually would win. So basically we all start with gamma. Start with gamma bigger, much bigger than H, but as the universe dilutes the particles, eventually this condition will be satisfied. So let's look at a specific example. Let's go back to when the universe is really, really young and really, really hot. So something, I don't know, just take it to be larger than 10 to the 3 GeV. That's probably safe. So when universe has a temperature this high, the reason that this number is chosen is basically, as you would learn in a standard model course, the mass is given by this Higgs particle, which has been discovered in this decade. So if we go so far above such that the Higgs mechanism didn't happen, the symmetry is restored, then we can consider all particles in the universe soup massless. We're going an all massless limit. You just heat, you just go backwards, heat up the universe really, really, really hot, such that it's hotter than anything that ever exists. So we just have a huge soup of radiation. So that's what happens in the far back of the universe, at least all the standard model particles that we know that exist, they will all be massless. Now, it's nice, because if we take this limit, which means that's the only energy scale is provided by the temperature. So we can happily use dimension analysis. Says, well, if you have anything that you want to look like that has a unit of any sort, I can estimate it by temperature because there's nothing else I can use. All mass are zero. So if we do that, so gamma will be given by, well, it's a rate, so it's 1 over time. But time is inverse energy, which is temperature, so gamma is T. If you are not happy with this, there is also gamma depends on how many number of particles are around, the number density depends on cross-section that you happily calculate a few, and depends on how fast they are moving towards each other. But we are in the massless limit, so that's all relativistic. That's one. The number's density is defined by something like a number divided by volume. Cross-section is the area. So it's something 1 over length. And again, 1 over length is the same as temperature, is the same as energy. So always remember this crazy thing after we pick the natural units. Everything is energy. Okay, so I'm convinced that this happens. So what about a Hubble parameter? We're going to take the approach of rewriting this very famous equation. Is that there is some energy scale hidden in the gravitational constant. So the approach is to take this to start using the units of M Planck. So if you just take G and H bar and H and C, I'm not gonna write it down. But like say H bar and G and C has a bunch of units, you say let's combine them to get a unit of energy out. That's a well-defined dimensional analysis problem. Then you will realize that's the result. There's some H bar and C is taken to be one because you're already used to that. So in this choice of unit, we get rid of that dependence on energy, which is captured here. So this is our Friedmann equation written in terms of Planck mass, a Planck scale. It's easier. So that's why there is, we just sneak in the 8 pi in there so that we define a reduced Planck scale. So that's, you actually want to pay attention. Square root of 8 pi is a factor of 5. When I was working on my PhD, then I have a project. I have to use an astrophysicist's code. And somehow for a very long time, I'm just looking at the code and the result, there's a factor of 5 missing. And then eventually I discovered that we're using different definition of M Planck. It's something that different field of people using different conventions, and that might somehow impact on research. But now we have this, which is nice. As we're gonna see, all right now we can just do dimension analysis because energy density is one factor of energy divided by the volume, and the volume, inverse volume, is 3 factor of energy. We're gonna derive the precise dependence, but we're just gonna do dimension analysis right now. We know that it's T to the fourth, and 3, who cares? So that's M Planck square. So H is T square over M Planck. So now we can finally compare these two things. It says we should have T, so we're going to calculate something very intuitive, which is gamma over H, which is T. So we compare, says, if universe is hot enough, everything is massless, then the interaction rate over Hubble rate is M Planck over temperature. By the way, we have no idea what happens at M Planck. So which means that any temperature that our assumption is valid, the interaction rate is always higher than Hubble. So the universe is always in equilibrium until, you know, some things have mass, which is at weak scale, like 100 GeV. So after that, that's your homework. That's precisely like your homework. Your homework is to study, okay, we can't just be that simple. Basically, your homework is studying when sigma has some energy dependence. What happens? We're going to use four Fermi theory, so not the weak theory. No, it's still dimension analysis, not calculating a cross-section. You probably have that pleasure to do it in your next course in standard model. You don't look very happy about it. But okay, well, you have to calculate some Feynman diagram in standard model course. Anyway, the point is that after this, things become slightly complicated, but the idea is the same. You calculate the interaction rate, go to compare with the Hubble rate. And if something falls out of equilibrium, they fall out of equilibrium. Then that's actually when you're super excited. This is called the key event, that the universe actually changes. You know, I mean, if the universe is bent of particles forever in equilibrium, it's probably not going to be very interesting. At least life is probably not supported by, you know, the whole universe in local thermal equilibrium all the time. So now we're just going to list, actually do the history study and see what happens. And it's just a beautiful table of the history, which is here. So let's go backwards in time. There is 14 Gallier years, which is, of course, so you we list when it happens, and what's the redshift, and then what's the energy scale, and then some notes. Well, this is coming from today's temperature of the universe. We haven't go back yet. And this is present. Lots of interesting things going on, but the cosmologists don't care that much. They look back into the far back in the universe, and something happens here, which don't worry about this precise number, but this is one. At that time, let's write a rule, that's when the dark energy takes over. And of course, one version of cosmology constant problem is understand why this is so close to the present. But we discuss about that. And something happens at about this, which we are not going to discuss, which is at some, so this is when galaxy is formed. As I say, galaxy formation is a hard topic that research is still going on, so we're not going to discuss that. And then we go back further. This is the time at 1,000. We mentioned this briefly. Says that the photon decouples. And this is CMB. And a little bit before then, the temperature is a little bit higher. And this is recombination. So basically, it just says that it takes a little bit of time for the proton and the electron combine into hydrogen. So this is the topic of tomorrow. We'll see that how we can produce CMB. Observing is another complicated topic. I'll briefly mention it, but this is how it's produced. And then we'll keep going back. This we already know at 60,000, something like that. So this is when radiation equals matter. So radiation takes over. And then, we come to 3 minutes. Apparently nothing really interesting happened until all the way back to 3 minutes. And this is at 100 keV. And this is BBN, Big Bang Nucleosynthesis. And then there is a type called a 6 second. And this is at 500 keV. And then this is when electron positron annihilates. And this event is interesting because at that time, neutrino already decoupled at 1 second. Okay, let me write down the next line too. At 1 second, about 1 megaeV, neutrino decouples. So it's interesting that after neutrino decouple, the electron and positron annihilates, dump a bunch of energy into the photons, but the neutrino decoupled, so neutrino didn't get any of this energy. So this is what you're going to study in the homework, that you realize actually neutrino is actually cooler than the photon. So this is studying homework 2. Decouple. And then plus this tells you that if you measure the temperature of a neutrino, I think it's something like 1.9 Kelvin. It's cooler than it's cooler than the photon. Well, how to measure neutrino temperature, that's another measure. I think people are still trying to do it. And then we have a bunch of question mark because we have no idea what's going on. But we believe dark matter at some point it will decouple from the universe and become dark. Bunch of question mark. And then the next thing we have some idea what happens is happen at the 200 mega electron volts. And that's when the QCD transition, which means they all bonded to become a neutron and a proton. So this is the one neutrons and protons form before it's just quark, gluon, plasma. So that's also, then if you go further, maybe 10 seconds, and then this is where it's about 10 TeV. It's basically what our collider can reach here. This is when electroweak symmetry is restored and collider physics, roughly it's restored at something like hundreds of GeV. And then there's collider physics here and the Higgs mechanism. And then this is your topic in your standard model course. So we're not going to discuss this. And then there's more question marks. So let's see. Right down in the bottom is at the Planck time and Planck temperature, then we have quantum gravity. Now, I don't know what's quantum gravity yet. Nobody knows. So then in the middle of this part, it's just between electroweak symmetry breaking end there, we know something happens. Precisely one, we don't know, and this is where inflation, maybe supersymmetry, maybe grand unification theory, and all sorts of fun stuff that we can just speculate. So that is a brief history of the universe. And that is Wednesday tutorial. And that's homework two. If we go further back, that's particle physics. And we have already done everything that already happened after a certain point. Okay. So, as I said, it's about a hot mess. So now we're going to try to study some tools to deal with this hot mess. It's in the notes. So about the precise number, you can look at the notes, but that's the order what happens. So if you, as universe evolves, at first, maybe inflation happens, maybe something else, but we know that at the level of TeV, or hundreds of GeV, that's where electroweak theory has a phase transition. And we have another phase transition at 200 MeV. That's the QCD transition. And after that, it's all standard model physics plus, after that, it's nice. It's just protons and the neutrons and electrons and the photons. And after that, the neutrinos decouple, and the neutrino is actually the normal thing. It just expands. The photons get the same energy because electron positron annihilate, and then it's universe cools down even more. Then the nuclei, like a the proton and the neutron is managed to stick to each other and form some heavier nuclei. Helium-4 is really stable, so that's what they form. And then we're going to, then they if you cool the universe even further, the nuclei is able to capture some electrons and form the atoms. And that's what happens with combination. Because then the universe is neutral, photon decouple, and it become the CMB we see today. And after that, we get to present. So that's the universe in the forward direction. So we need some tools to study this. So the approach of the lecture we're going to use is to basically assuming that we have a soup that is in local equilibrium, which we have all sorts of nice technique to deal with because they are in local equilibrium. So we can use thermodynamics. And then something happened. And then they become two separate soup because they are no longer in thermal equilibrium with each other, something decoupled. Then we can still use thermal equilibrium within themselves. Normally, basically, we just say, okay, you decoupled, then you just behave like a normal bunch of particles as universe expands, your density drops as 1/volume. And the rest are still in thermal equilibrium. And then, of course, there is this transition time that the universe is briefly not in thermal equilibrium, which is important because it has to exist. If it doesn't exist, then nothing decouples and we have no atoms, so that's bad. But our approach is going to, it's sort of, we know what happens before the non-equilibrium starts, and we know what happens after non-equilibrium stop. And we just sort of draw a line between them. It's sort of like we know two dots, and then we link them in some weird curve. You can actually go through that process. So the first thing I want to write down is, suppose we do want to understand what happens in that brief period of out of equilibrium, and then maybe you understand why that I decide not to do it. So the first thing we're going to study is when equilibrium. So this is really inspired by one of your very good questions. That the question is that so far it seems we have been taking the following approach. Our approach says number density decays as 1 over volume. Or in other words, we claim that the number is a constant. And as a direct result of that, of course, is the derivative equals 0. And I can, and then if you work this out, you will see something really familiar. It's dn dt plus 3hn equals 0. So that was our approach before. And then one of you guys asked a very interesting question. Says, but how do we know that this thing holds for every single species? So there is some, so subtlety says this holds for every single species, and this is called the no interaction limit. If nothing is interacting with each other, of course, the number of the particles should fall off as 1 over volume, and that equation should hold. But of course, the particles interact with each other. Think about a universe with all the particles. They never interact with each other. It will be a very boring universe. So then we have to do modification of this thing. And this modification is called Boltzmann equation. I assume it's discovered by Boltzmann. So the modification is replace the right-hand side by some collision term that basically depends on all the particle species that we think is going to interact with it. So now the right-hand side is not a zero, but it's something complicated. This depends on all the species. So they basically coupled all the equations together. So now if we want to study some number of species of number densities, and they are related to each other with some interaction, and if they are not in equilibrium, the correct thing to do is to solve this coupled differential equations. So let's take a look what kind of collision terms we are talking about. So as in QFT, that let's focus our attention to 2-to-2 scattering. It's not that bad assumption. I mean, it's how hard it'll be for three particles somehow to meet together. So let's focus on 2-to-2 scattering. This says particle 1 plus 2 and is going to 3-to-4. And it's not in equilibrium. It's just a reaction can happen in both directions. Which from QFT, you know that they all happen in different directions. It's just sometimes one direction is much preferred. So if that happens, then the collision term is given by, it's not too bad a, it's not too hard to understand why it sort of look like this. It basically says if you have some 1-2 particles, it's going to interact and become something else, so that will decrease the number density of particle one because it destroys particle one. And then if you have a lot of three and a four, then the reverse interaction is going to happen that will increase the part number one. So if I'm starting study number one, then you can understand why that this is a decreasing and that's a destroying process and that's a production process. And alpha is happily given by cross-section, of course. That's what describes how strongly the interaction is. But a beta is actually not independent. Beta, because we know one thing, is this thing is going to vanish at the equilibrium. Then we go back to the Mary case that the right-hand side that is zero. So you can actually solve beta in terms of alpha as long as you take all these densities to be at equilibrium. So since I'm not very interested in solving that coupled equations, so we're going to do it in the approach of just draw some interpolation lines in between. If you want to further know, if I just really want to solve Boltzmann equation, which it's, sometimes it's not too bad because you can imagine it's like particle and antiparticle become particle and antiparticle, then it's not a four equations, like two. So if you are interested in solving them, I refer you to Daniel Bauman's lecture notes. In chapter three, in several cases, he actually solved the Boltzmann equation. But we're going to do some approximations. Okay, so that's how much I want to talk about the non-equilibrium, is that you can deal with it. It's just make things a lot harder. So let's go to equilibrium. In the case of equilibrium, that we've already seen this, I'll just write down the factors back, which is that. That's the distribution function that, okay. It's something like plus minus one, and this is Fermi. This is boson. Okay. So then you can calculate a rho, which is the same thing except you replace the one here by the energy. And you can calculate the pressure, which are the three things we're interested in this class. There's pressure, is given by, actually we did that, p squared over 3e. Okay, so the next step is of course do these integrals. So we're going to take the relativistic limit, which is the temperature is the most important thing, who cares about else? And then we'll take the non-relative relativistic limit, which is the mass, that is the most important thing, who cares about everything, anything else? So I doubt you want to see me integrate a fermion, all boson distribution function. Unless somehow I was wrong about you. I don't know. I've been, you know, teaching for a while. So I hope that I can try to do it. But it's really take one of those equations, make this limit, change the integral from p to e, and hopefully with this limit, you can drop some term, and then you change something like e over t, define it to be change of variable into x, and then you find the x integral, then you're like, oh, I'm stuck because I don't know how to do this integral. Then you check the integral book, you get a result. It's on the notes, you can read about it, but I doubt you want to see me on board, so I'm just gonna write out the results. It takes a couple pages. And if you never want to see how these integrals are done, it's okay that the key equations are boxed, and there are two pages of changing variable doing integrals. And there are some fun integral fact. But I'll just write down the result. And also because, say, we don't know how to do the integral, the answer is in terms of zeta function. So the result, there is a boson, there's fermion. And you also can do with it for the energy density. So this result is when we take the relativistic limit, basically photon and things are really, really light. Or just lighter than the universe at that temperature. So, well, it's good to notice that rho is indeed proportion to t to the fourth, n is indeed proportion to t to the three. So if we are talking about photons and using photons to measure temperature, that t, so this gives you the best proof that t is indeed proportional to 1 over a. And of course, you can calculate the pressure. No doubt you're going to find it. It's 1 over 3 rho. Okay, is that okay? That you can check out the integrals later. I'll just believe that everybody who did the integral get the constants right. And then for the non-relativistic limit, basically that plus minus 1 is not important anymore. You just integrate it over exponential function, but then you have to do some, for example, you can't integrate from zero anymore because you have the lowest energy available is mass. But you can do it after, I don't know, three or four lines of fun integrals to do. You get this result, which we're going to use a bunch of times. The key thing to remember here is that the power law behavior is as we expected. The key thing to realize here, it's what David says, that is that the equilibrium hates massive particles. Because there is an exponential suppress. So if you just let a massive particle drop out of, if massive particles is always in equilibrium, there's nothing left. So for example, if in this universe, that if all it happens is everything maintains the thermal equilibrium forever, and then we just calculate all the density according to these thermodynamics things. And then you will not find any massive particle because the temperature just keep dropping. And it will just be harder and harder suppressed. The reason that we do have some massive particles around is, of course, because they are, at some point, they decouple. Once decoupled, then the number density just drops in the usual way, like 1 over volume. So the last thing I want to do today is to draw a picture of what will in general happen, which will happen a few times. In a few times tomorrow in the lecture and the tutorial, what in general would happen is that, so first, let's explain the axis. What is drawing here is the co-moving number density. Because as I said, the number density will drop as 1 over volume if there's no interaction. So let's get the volume factor back. So we know that as soon as that happens, I can just draw straight lines because 1 over A3, not that easy to draw. Well, straight lines is also not that easy. But okay, here is the time. But equipped with our all knowledge about how to characterize the time in the universe, we're going to label this as the mass of a particular mass particle divided by temperature. So if say as we go in this direction, the temperature is dropping. And which means M over T must be increasing. So it just says as universe evolves, M over T is increasing. So it's also sort of, it's going, the time arrow is going the correct direction. So let's see. Let's start the plot at 1. So at here, it's the time 1. The particle started to become non-relativistic. According to our formula, that's what's it going to do. It's just plummet. So this is equilibrium. So if the massive particle is forever in equilibrium with the rest of the particle, we're not going to see any of them today because they are exponentially suppressed. So what actually happened is here, at here, suppose this is when gamma is approximately h. So at here, the particles start to, the interaction rate can't keep up with the Hubble rate, so the particles start to go out of equilibrium. And what we know is, when it's decoupled, it's a straight line. So at the beginning, it's the same. As long as the interaction is fast enough, that's fine, the same. And then this is something called the relic density, because it's, I don't know how to explain the English word, a relic. It's like what's left over. And it doesn't change anymore. The only thing that it change is because the volume. And then you know there is something in the middle, it's the non-equilibrium. And we're taking approach taking these 2 points at the same, and which works amazingly well in lots of order of magnitude and like calculation. So this picture is the most important thing to remember today. Is that that's how we have some massive particle at the end of the day. Is because at some point they decouple from the thermal bus and then they just chill. And tomorrow we're going to apply what we learned to the era of CMB and they say how basically photons eventually decouple from the universe and become something observable.